When I was in the sixth grade, right before the 1-2 punch of puberty in junior high, I knew virtually nothing about popular music. I didn't listen to the radio, I didn't read magazines. The only music I did hear was whatever was playing on classical WIAA. One day, my sixth grade teacher told a story about how you shouldn't hire somebody by the hour, because he had once hired somebody to rake his lawn for $5 an hour and came back a few hours later to discover that the kid had done nothing but drink soda and push a couple of leaves around. Since then, Mr. B said, he only hires people by the job and not by the hour. At recess, I asked him what he paid to get his lawn raked, and when he told me he paid $20 for the job, I nearly fell over. $20! That was an inconceivable amount of money, as I was currently on my 35 cents a week allowance. And of that, I could spend the quarter any way I wanted, but I had to save the dime for college. I told my friend and classmate Mel about it, and we agreed to split the job and the money. We approached Mr. B about it, and he hired us to come out that weekend. Now, it's not that Mr. B had a particularly big yard, but there were an unimaginable number of leaves on it, and after raking for a couple of hours, I was beginning to feel that we were the suckers for taking the job for only $20, when that morning I figured we were taking Mr. B to the cleaners. Mel and I had figured that one Saturday afternoon would be enough, but it soon became clear that we'd have to come back. Many times. And each time we came back, it seemed like Mr. B had trucked in another couple of tons of leaves. Okay, I lied earlier. It is true that I hadn't yet experienced the ego jolt of junior high, but the sweaty fingers of puberty were already starting to close around me. I had suddenly, inexplicably, started noticing the girls in our class in a different way. My thoughts had started straying into some vast, unknown areas, and the peach fuzz on my cheek was just starting to shadow. I was months away from my first surprising, paradigm-shifting orgasm. Oh, I get it. But the sap was starting to flow. Mr. B was, hands down, the hippest of our provincial school's 8 teachers. He had a mustache, drove a Camaro, and coached the basketball and football teams. Although the ideas of teachers having sex was entirely uncontemplatable, I had just recently learned that they had lives outside the classroom, Mr. B nevertheless seemed like quite the swinger, or at least the one who most wanted to swing, which, in a small town like the one I grew up in, probably meant he was the most frustrated teacher in our school. It also meant that he had the largest porn collection imaginable. These days, you could discreetly house hundreds of magazines worth of prurient pulchritude on your hard drive, so I've heard. But back in those dark analog days, if you wanted several hundred skin magazines around the house, you had to have several hundred skin magazines around the house. Every surface of Mr. B's house dripped with playboys and penthouses, as well as legions of lesser mags, your hustlers, your knaves, your Adams, and what have you. I discovered his vast collection by merely coming in the house to use the bathroom. Current issues of everything imaginable lay around the tables and counters of the house, and the archives were kept in giant stacks in the unattached garage, as I discovered when I went looking for a shovel. Well, over the next couple of weekends, I found plenty of occasions to come to his house and use the bathroom. Although I was, as stated, still months from that portentous physical turning point, the pumps were primed and ready, and the casual interest in naked women I had harbored since childhood was quickly turning into an obsession, invading my thoughts night and day. I couldn't wait until that mythical far-off day when beautiful women consented to let me see them naked. I still can't wait for that day. And I savored any chance I got to study their exotic forms. I must say, much of the allure of the magazines such as these is not so much that the women are naked, but that, in most of the photos, these beautiful naked women boldly and calmly meet your gaze. They know you can see all of them, and they don't care. So intimate is your relationship with them. Living with my mom, I didn't have much of a chance to explore my interests, although I did find a penthouse buried in a stack of dance magazines where, I'm certain, my mom thought it was safe from my prying eyes. I preserved the illusion by carefully putting it back in place after finishing looking at it, but I did practically memorize that entire issue. But still, I wanted more. I needed to study the different aspects of different bodies, to see variations of areola, to measure curves and mass, to assess different asses, to see what I liked. I needed more research material. A lot more. One dark morning later that summer, I slid out of bed, dressed carefully, put on an empty backpack, slipped a flashlight in my pocket, and quietly got on my bike. I rode out to Mr. B's, several miles away, in the perfect silence and uninterrupted darkness of a rural night. It was around 3 a.m, and there was no indication that anybody else was even alive at that hour. I parked my bike in the woods and walked the last mile to his house, heart drumming in my head, footsteps pounding on my ears, sweaty hands nervously fingering the dark flashlight. When I got to his garage, I stood perfectly still in the shadows for 10 minutes, making sure nobody was around or awake. Then I very carefully crept in through the door, lit the flashlight into my palm, and seeped a little of the light onto the far wall. There they were, stacks of magazines, hundreds, if not thousands, of bodies to be studied and appreciated. I shakily turned the flashlight off and set it on a shelf by the door. Silently, I stepped around the silver Camaro and slipped the backpack off. With sweaty, trembling fingers, I quickly loaded my backpack with all it could hold, probably 30 to 40 different magazines, chosen semi-randomly. I focused on the Playboys and Penthouses, but some darker need caused me to grab a couple of Hustlers, too. Oh, you're gonna take me home tonight. Oh, down beside that red firelight. I carefully put the backpack on and skulked back to the door. A quick, panicked search in the dark on the shelf failed to turn up the flashlight. I fumbled for it for a few seconds and, unable to find it, cut my losses and slipped out the door and back into the woods to my bike. I rode the few miles home undetected by anybody, hid the magazines in the basement, and went back to bed. Left alone with Big Fat Fatty, she was such a naughty natty. Hey, big woman, you made a bad boy out of me. For weeks, I worried about that flashlight. It had my fingerprints all over it, and Mr. B would surely discover it when he noticed that some of his magazines were gone. The fact that my fingerprints weren't on file anywhere didn't comfort me. In my guilty conscience, I might as well have had my name and phone number etched into the case. Fortunately, that particular crime went unsolved, and now the statute of limitations has expired three times over. I feel safe in acknowledging my first foray across the legal tracks to the dark side of town. I've been singing with my band, across the water, across the land. I've seen every blue-eyed Susie on the way. But their beauty and their style were kind of smooth after a while. Take me to their dirty ladies every time. Come on! Oh, won't you take me home tonight? Those magazines sustained me, and worried my mom, for years afterwards, until she donated them to the man who would eventually become my stepfather. Hey, listen here. He kept them in his pre-divorce apartment, in the back room where I slept when my mom was busy being the other woman, so I would have something distracting to do while they didn't want to be disturbed. It was through studying the instructive text and the helpful visual aids in these magazines that I was finally able to achieve my first orgasm in the upstairs bathroom 1 week after my 13th birthday. I didn't even really know what I was doing, but as soon as I had done it, I understood the world in an entirely new way, and I've never been the same since. That job raking leaves has taken on an exaggerated significance over the years. Not only did it mark my plunge into puberty, but it signaled a number of other important developments. I was poised on the brink between boy and man, not only sexually, but socially as well. I was about to be thrown to the junior high wolves and exchange my youthful confidence for a nervous, wary modesty and uncertainty that has largely dogged me to this day. While raking with Mel, I suddenly became aware of our differences. Not our gender differences, which I had obviously known about for years, but class differences. Being spring in Michigan, there were lots of bugs around, and I asked her to pass me the insect repellent. Insect repellent? She shrieked. Insect repellent? Only you would call it insect repellent. What am I supposed to call it? I wondered. Bug spray, she yelled at my stupidity. But, I gestured to her, holding the can, what does it say here? I pointed to the label, where it clearly did not say bug spray. Yeah, I know what it says, she remarked, but nobody actually calls it that. It's bug spray, not insect repellent. What a dork. I pondered this. It was an insult that didn't particularly sting. I'd figured out long ago that being smart was not universally applauded, but I never cared about that. I was athletic enough to be accepted by the jocks for what I could do on the playground, and I was proud of being smart and didn't try to hide it. My friends were all smart, so it wasn't an issue between us. She wasn't deriding me because I was smart, but because I didn't mind showing it. Using the proper term when everyone else spoke colloquially was viewed with skepticism, evidence of the kind of book learning that the mostly simple, that is to say, stupid, people around where I grew up reviled. Although I lived in rural Michigan, I inhabited the bubble world of the Interlochen Arts Academy. Mel, though living less than a mile away from me, inhabited an entirely different world. She had long ago learned to camouflage her intelligence and didn't have the protection of a bunch of smart, creative people around her to cushion her from the local culture. She had once said that my house reeked of culture, and she spit out culture like it was a bug in her mouth, or rather, like it was an insect in her oral cavity. Mel couldn't afford to be cultured and smart, certainly couldn't flaunt it, so she laughed at my insect repellent behind her wall of bug spray. At that point, our differences didn't matter, but as soon as our paths separated and I went to the academy and she went to the local high school, our friendship quietly sputtered and died. But the most significant aspect of raking that lawn occurred when we finally finished it. Mr. B begrudgingly gave us two $10 bills. We hadn't done as pristine a job as he would have liked, but he was tired of us coming over. We thanked him profusely and jumped on our bikes and headed gleefully home. I had $10 in my pocket and felt like the richest man in the world.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality.
As to what I was going to do with my share, I already had it planned out, and on the way home, we stopped at the drugstore, and I bought my first 45 single for a buck, leaving $9 to put towards my college education.
I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy, because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low.
That 45 was the first record I ever bought, and it was Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead. Just begun, but now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama, ooh, didn't mean to make you cry. If I'm not back again this time tomorrow, carry on, carry on. Is it nothing really?
Although I lived a sheltered musical life, I didn't grow up in a cave, so I had at least heard some popular music. None of it ever really caught my ear until Mel played Bohemian Rhapsody for me.
Too late. My time has come. Sent shivers down my spine.
She thought it was hysterical, and it certainly was unlike anything else I had heard. Although bookended with boring rock cliches, the middle of the song launched off into an amazing faux opera, complete with multiple harmonies and wild histrionics.
I see a little silhouette of a man. Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango? Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo,
Galileo,
Galileo, Figaro.
Magnifico!
Just a poor boy from a poor family, spare him his life from this monstrosity.
He
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah, no, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go! Mamma mia, mamma mia!
Mamma mia, let me go! Beelzebub has the devil put aside for me! For me! For me!
It was startling and much more intriguing than the usual Eagles, Kris Kristofferson, Jim Croce suspects that Mel played for me. Then somebody brought the album in to share with the class during music and was able to slip it by on the strength of that song. Our music teacher had little patience for then-popular music and wouldn't let us play any of it, but the strange middle section of Bohemian Rhapsody puzzled her, so she let it go by. At least until Death on Two Legs came on, and Freddie Mercury shouted out,
"Now you can kiss my ass goodbye."
Whereupon she vaulted over to the record player and knocked the needle off, and we were forever forbidden from bringing our own music in. When I got home, I played my new record over and over and over again, the first of what was to become many musical obsessions, much to my mother's dismay. Other songs I just could not get enough of when I first heard them were Ultravox's Sleepwalk, the B-52's Rock Lobster, and Jay Giles' Love Stinks. But I digress. Although she could stand Bohemian Rhapsody, the flip side, I'm in love with my car, made my mother's hair bristle, an effect that was not lost on me. All bluster and guitar, I'm in love with my car is not a good song, but it was the first time I understood the pure visceral thrill of the snarling guitars and thundering drums of real rock music.
My hand on your grease gun.
I eventually acquired Night at the Opera, the album that spawned Bohemian Rhapsody, and was delighted to discover that it was a lot more varied than I thought possible for a rock group. In addition to the faux opera of Bohemian Rhapsody and the pedal-to-the-metal rock of I'm in Love with My Car, there were ballads and very experimental, and very bad, musical pastiches, and several examples of what can only be characterized as music hall tunes. Perhaps this rock music wasn't as monolithic as I thought, or rather, as I had been led to believe. So, for better or worse, my very first record was the Bohemian Rhapsody single. And it almost wasn't a single to begin with. As I heard it told, Queen approached their label with Bohemian Rhapsody and wanted it released as a single. The record company laughed, and when they realized that Queen was serious, put their foot down unequivocally. It's too weird, and it's way too long for a single, they said. End of discussion. So the band took it to a local DJ, this was in Boston, I believe, and told him that this was their new song, but under no circumstances should he play it on the air. The DJ understood perfectly and played it several times that weekend, and the station got so many calls that the record company was forced to release it as a single. And I was forced to buy it, and the rest, as they say, is history. Produced, like most of their albums, by the legendarily anal Roy Thomas Baker, see The Cars, Night at the Opera has a gigantic sound and is frightfully good ear candy. Even the hideously awful Prophet song is made somewhat bearable, a couple of times through anyway, by the inventive production. For years, Queen proudly stamped no synthesizers were used on this album on the back of their records, partly to showcase Baker's astonishing studio wizardry, and partly to align Queen with other heavy metal bands, like Led Zeppelin, who thought that the synthesizer was a wussy instrument.
Everybody in the morning should do a good time. All right. Everybody in the nighttime should have a good time. All night. Now we got a movement.
In a satisfying payback, Larry Fast, also known as Synergy, proudly stated that no electric guitars were used on his albums. Vengeance was mine. Queen was a schizophrenic band.
Well, you're just 17. All you wanna do is disappear.
They could rock like any of the heavy-hitting ultra-macho bands of the time, but they also showed a streak of tenderness that most of those bands wouldn't dare show. Freddie Mercury, the group's flamboyant singer, added a sense of camp theatricality to the mix, and although he stayed in the closet until AIDS dragged his corpse out of it, his bisexual politics informed much of their material, including their very name. In a surreal twist, one of their biggest songs, We Are the Champions, a gay rights anthem, became a huge sports victory celebration staple. The irony is sweet, much like watching fiercely homophobic men waving their arms around on the dance floor to the Village People's YMCA, who have no idea what the song is really about. Although critically panned, Rolling Stone famously called one of their albums fascistic, they were enormously popular, especially in England, where they were second only to the Beatles in popularity and collectability. Although they proudly touted their lack of synthesizers for years, when they decided to finally add them on 1980's The Game, they went whole hog, and there's barely a guitar to be heard on the album.
Let's go! He walks fairly down the street with the brim pool way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of his feet. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip. To the sound of the beat, yeah.
The Game was their last worthwhile album, and put an end to a remarkable string of records during the 1970s. In many ways, they represented everything that the punks hated about 70s rock, and the operatic facade of their music was what the Ramones burned to the ground in 1977. Glamorous, theatrical, campy, over-the-top, rocking, nostalgic, earnest, Queen went places no other band dared, and reaped enormous rewards by doing so. But more important than all the sales and the hits and the gender bending and the public awareness they brought to AIDS was the fact that they produced the very first record I ever bought and sent me, teetering between boy and man, between confident and scared, headlong into the world of music. They were the first band to befriend me, and the friendship that they offered, the musical camaraderie, has never let me down.
It's tea, it's tea. of my